You turn to Marketplace for the latest news about what's happening in the economy and how it impacts you and your community. When you donate to support our nonprofit newsroom, you can also get something a little more tangible. We've got a great lineup of donor thank you gifts right now, a shrinkflation mini tote bag, water bottles, mugs, hats, and yes, the Kai PA glasses are back, but only while supplies last, and I'm taking some of them. Contribute any amount to make a difference and pick up one of these gifts. Go to marketplace.org/donate. In which podcasts take center stage, making the business model work. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today. This one is the 6th of December. Good as always to have you along, everybody. There are those who will argue, and honestly, no offense intended here, but logistics is very few people's idea of sexy, which I get. Unless you want your stuff, whether you're a buyer or a seller, to get where it is supposed to be on time. That is the setup for this. We've got an update on the state of the shipping industry this week, courtesy of the latest Logistics Managers Index. Pretty weak in November, actually, down the most since April of 2022, back when companies had way too much inventory on hand, inventory that was getting stale since people weren't buying much of it, a very undesirable situation. But as Marketplace's Justin Ho reports to get us going, the weakness in logistics now is less concerning.
All that inventory that was building up around April of last year was not that great for the overall economy.
Warehousing and storage costs went up to the highest levels that we've pretty much ever seen.
Zach Rogers is a professor at Colorado State University.
And that was a real contributor to the inflation that we saw in the spring and summer of 2022.
Rogers helps put together the Logistics Managers Index. And he says now the sector is looking weaker because inventory levels are down. That's because consumers are buying a lot of that inventory.
You know, Thanksgiving, Cyber Monday, Black Friday, we had spending all the way through. And it looks like we're going to have a bigger holiday season than we did last year.
Meanwhile, retailers are trying to keep their shelves pretty lean, says Jason Miller, a professor of supply chain management at Michigan State University.
As supply chains have normalized, you just don't need as much inventory to keep those customers happy.
Miller says that's encouraging for freight prices after they took off like a rocket earlier in the pandemic.
And even though we've come down steeply, prices are still more expensive today than what they were 4 years ago for a lot of these services.
The logistics sector has plenty of room to grow, says Lisa Elram, a professor at Miami University in Ohio. She says it should do that by becoming more efficient, not more bloated. Companies might invest more in electric delivery vehicles or in AI to improve inventory management.
So that we can have lower logistics costs and good customer service, but don't necessarily need more inventory to do that.
Elram says we can expect inventories to stay low as supply chains continue to stabilize. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, kind of weak, actually, waiting, I would guess, for the jobs report coming out on Friday. We will have the details when we do the numbers. As I said a minute ago, the November jobs report is going to be out on Friday morning. The economy was 150,000 jobs to the good in October, but one industry actually did lose jobs, 7,500 of them. Food service and drinking places is the actual category heading from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. It's restaurants and bars to you and me. 7,500 is not a whole lot in the grand scheme of things. Restaurants do employ about 15.5 million people in this economy, after all. It's the second biggest private sector employer after healthcare. But 7,500 ain't nothing. Here's Marketplace's Sabri Benishore.
If you thought you've seen sticker shock at a restaurant, try being the restaurant. J.R. Ruxasuan is co-owner of Chalong, an upscale Thai restaurant in Hell's Kitchen, New York.
A pack of chicken. So it used to be, before the pandemic, it used to be just $40 a pack, like this big.
Picture a wholesale bag of chicken the size of a fold-out menu.
It's $40 a pack, but now it's like $110. Can you imagine that?
he had to raise menu prices, and that did not go over so well.
So the people, they just start complaining about why everything is so expensive than before, but now people kind of like, you know, getting used to it with the prices.
The settling in of higher prices may be contributing to a slowdown in parts of the restaurant industry, says Alex Suskind, professor of food and beverage management at Cornell.
Inflation numbers have cooled a little bit, but they haven't cooled universally across the economy. So there's some people that still have higher costs to incur. And so there is some consumer-based resistance when you raise prices.
Particularly at sit-down restaurants. Greg Thomas is a managing director at BDO.
In September and October, we've seen significant decreases in guest traffic. Significant, like 5 to 10% decreases.
Hiring in the restaurant industry has slowed down too. It is on average still growing, but it has been bumpy. In two of the last 3 months, the industry actually lost a few thousand jobs. And that may be more than just the aftermath of high prices.
Restaurant industry employment growth essentially mirrors on a macro scale what goes on with national employment growth.
Hudson Reilly is Senior Vice President of Research at the National Restaurant Association.
Look at national employment growth. It still is positive, but it has been moderating over the past couple years.
But one way the restaurant industry stands out from just about every other major industry is it still has not regained the level of employment it had before the pandemic.
We're 14,000 jobs shy.
Again, Greg Thomas at BDO. This isn't true for every type of restaurant. Fast food employment is up 3% compared to before the pandemic.
Limited service restaurants, which you would know as the coffee brands out there, or ice cream stores, that kind of thing, they're up 128,000 jobs, 13% increase over pre-pandemic.
The problem is the sit-down restaurants and the fine dining places.
They're down 214,000 jobs, and that's 4% lower.
In Houston, Texas, there is a clue as to why.
This is Tracy Vaught. I'm the president of H-Town Restaurant Group. And the sounds you're hearing are the sounds in our kitchen at Backstreet Cafe getting ready for lunch service.
H-Town Restaurant Group includes Backstreet Cafe and four other restaurants, employing 450 people.
Well, it used to be a little higher per restaurant before the pandemic, but it's less now. Just trying to run a tighter ship, I would say.
Doing more with less, streamlining the business model. These have been necessities for restaurants reeling from inflation, rising wages, and less traffic from office buildings. With more takeout and delivery orders post-pandemic, some restaurants have beefed up kitchen staff and dropped waiters. Some of the bigger chains have set up kiosks and QR code ordering. Vaught has set up other streams of income, catering for sports teams and colleges. It has been a lot to juggle.
You've got like increased costs, increased prices, decreased customer, you know, they're trying to eliminate tipping and raise minimum wage and everything. I was like, guys, you know, just leave us alone for a little while.
Restaurant work has never been stress-free, but these days, even on the other side of the pandemic, there are new stresses to worry about. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Women hold, give or take, only about a third of all the jobs in STEM fields in this economy. Science, technology, engineering, and math, right? And that is after all the work that's gone into getting more women and girls involved. Gallup, in fact, just did a big survey of Gen Z, people between 12 and 26. It shows 85% of boys and men say they are interested in a career in STEM compared to 63% of women and girls. Marketplace's Samantha Fields has more on that.
Growing up in India, Anjana Sasarla was surrounded by scientists and engineers.
And my mother, she was a chemistry professor. So that was what inspired me to get into STEM.
Sasarla is now a professor of responsible AI at Michigan State University. She studied mechanical engineering in college in the early 90s. And there
were two women in a class of 80.
That's 80. For much of her career, Sasarla says she's often been one of the only women in the room. And she thinks lack of representation is a big reason so many girls and women still don't go into STEM. Zach Ranowski at Gallup says their research backs that up.
The extent to which a young person says that they have a role model dramatically increases the likelihood that they say that they want to pursue a STEM career.
This new survey of Gen Z also shows that girls are much more likely than boys to say they don't think they'd be good at science or math.
That is concerning to us, especially because of all the work that's gone into bringing young women into the fold of STEM.
Some of that work has made a difference. Tarika Barrett, CEO of Girls Who Code, says girls who've gone through one of their programs are 7 times more likely to major in STEM, and girls of color are 9 times more likely.
So much of this is that these girls' first learning spaces are critical. Positive and supportive environments sustain interest. They definitely drive persistence.
And she says getting more women and people of color into tech is going to be critical to making the technology that shapes so much of our lives more equitable. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
Coming up, even if we're dying a slow, slow death, there's still a lot of juice to squeeze out of this.
That sounds unpleasant. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials off 70 points today, 0.2%, 36,054. The NASDAQ down 83 points, about 0.6% there, 14,146. S&P 500 gave up 17 points, 0.4%, 45,049. McDonald's says it's going to open more than 8,800 new locations by 2027. The fast food chain also announced a partnership with Alphabet's Google Cloud to use artificial intelligence in its operations. What could possibly go wrong? McDonald's shares ticked up just 0.1% on that news today. Bonds were up. That's the price. The yield went the other way, 4.12%. You're listening to Marketplace. You turn to Marketplace for the latest news about what's happening in the economy and how it impacts you and your community. When you donate to support our nonprofit newsroom, you can also get something a little more tangible. We've got a great lineup of donor thank you gifts right now, a shrinkflation mini tote bag, water bottles, mugs, hats, and yes, the Kai PA glasses are back, but only while supplies last, and I'm taking some of them. Contribute any amount to make a difference and pick up one of these gifts. Go to marketplace.org/donate. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We're going to do something now that we don't do very often. Air a chunk of another show and then have the host of that show on to talk about it. It being journalism and podcasting and what turns out to be the challenging economics of this industry of ours. And we're going to do it because this. By 2019, Edison Research figured about 90 million Americans were listening to podcasts every month. So radio, audio, right, was cool again. And venture capitalists were throwing millions of dollars at new podcasting companies. And everybody who was anybody in public radio was pitching podcasts to their bosses. But the bubble didn't last. Companies like Gimlet and Spotify, as well as public radio stations and NPR itself, wound up with big layoffs and small returns. So there was an episode of On the Media from WNYC Studios about a month or two ago about that podcast boom and bust. Michael Lowinger is the host, and we're going to have him on in just a minute. First, though, an excerpt from that episode. Micah chatting with Nick Kwa, who's a writer for New York Magazine and basically the podcast critic, about where public radio falls in this whole discussion.
Nick Kwa feels that by cutting much of their podcast-only shows, NPR and WNYC are setting themselves up for future failure.
It feels like both organizations are receding deeper and deeper into itself when it should be unfolding wider and expanding and trying to really reinvent itself for the changing media landscape, demographic, and the world that it exists in. If you are not reaching new people where they are, you will not be here in 20 years. It is as simple as that. I'm sorry. Like, I feel like I'm very angry. Like, I'm coming off very angry, and I am. But it's like, boy, nobody's asked me about this stuff for a while. And I'm like, really, I'm really pissed about it.
What? Why are you pissed?
Because, like, I value public radio. Like, I really value the enterprise of producing journalism and creative work that is for the public, that is, to a meaningful extent, disentangled from a pure for-profit capitalistic structure. You are in the position to produce more interesting and better work. Unimedia is like one of the greatest shows of all time. Like, if nobody is out here being angry, trying to like defend it and think about its future, then what the f*** are we doing?
NPR, WNYC, LAist. These guys have been in the podcast game for a long time, right? They didn't just dip their toes. And they're saying 10 years on of experimenting with podcasts, they're really expensive to make. You got to pay those hosts so much money. You got to fly them all around the place to report these fancy stories. It didn't work. So why are we chasing a unicorn when we've got Old Reliable over on 93.9?
Two things. One, Old Reliable is not going to be reliable forever. Something feels different about how fast things are changing and the way that we're moving today. And the second thing I'll say about it is that, did it fail because of the theory or did it fail because of the execution? I would argue it's the execution. I'll say it out loud. It does feel to a large extent like budget mismanagement.
Okay, so there is, as I said in the introduction, a lot in that episode of On the Media to talk about. We got Micah Loewinger on the phone to do exactly that. Micah, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
So as I also said up in the introduction, it's not just public radio, which has been challenged by the economics of the podcast industry, right? Spotify, just in the last couple of days, we've seen the news. Here's my question to you as we get going. How did the people who were in charge of the money, commercial or public broadcasting, get it so wrong?
I think it all started after the smash and unexpected success of Serial in 2014, where everyone wanted a big, fancy hit podcast. And all of these companies, new and old, public radio and private, threw a bunch of money into podcast departments. And I think they quickly learned that the economics of this high-quality journalism is complicated, and I just don't think the math panned out as many hoped it would.
Let's lay out the economics. You know them. You know the economics. I know the economics, but maybe not everybody listening does. What's the main challenge here?
The main challenge is that we basically have this term podcasting, but it's describing, roughly speaking, two very different things. One is the kind of journalism that I do it on the media and that I love to listen to, like The Serial, like This American Life, like More Perfect. These are beautiful, carefully reported and scripted shows that require teams and lots of time to make stories. Then we have what is commonly referred to in the industry as the always-on podcast, the kind of chat shows like Joe Rogan or Call Her Daddy or Pod Save America, where you have, you know, one, two, three celebrity or personalities who kind of shoot the breeze, can create a lot of content really, really fast and don't require that much production, don't require that much overhead. So the journalism, the really, really high quality, highly produced stuff is expensive to make. You can sell fewer ads. And when there's a big ad downturn like now, those shows, that business model is really vulnerable.
And we should say, and as you say in the longer episode, WNYC, whence On the Media comes, and KPCC, LAist in LA, and the parent company Marketplace APM have all had their challenges. I guess my question though is, did nobody see this coming? It's a little bit like the financial crisis, right? Home prices are only ever going to go up. Podcasting advertising is only ever going to go up.
You know, it's probably a different story for every one of these shops. And I'm kind of just a little bit of a worker bee who's seen it from the perspective of a producer. But I think so many people have tried to predict a hit in this industry. And the problem that we've seen is, one, it's so hard to predict a hit. And two, even the hits often aren't making back the money that they put in. There was a fascinating piece from the Columbia Journalism Review recently that found that when Amazon and iHeartMedia and Sony would pour upwards of $500,000 into a show, even if it was a hit and they had like a million plus listeners, they might only make half their money back. And this is not new. We have heard big leaders in the industry, like, for instance, the founder of Gimlet, Alex Blumberg, describe this openly years ago. And yet Spotify bought Gimlet hoping that they could spin the economics of this differently or differentiate themselves. And so it's been out there.
So look, if Spotify, which has spent $1 billion on podcasting, which bought Gimlet for something like $200 million, which just this week canceled a show, Stolen, which won a Pulitzer and a Peabody, if they're throwing all this money at it and can't get it right, what are those of us in more traditional public media who like to make the longer, capital-intensive, but really good, thorough investigative journalism, what are we supposed to do with that?
I don't know. I'm asking that question too. I mean, I'm looking around at some of my favorite hosts, like Jonathan Goldstein from Heavyweight, Anna Sale from Death, Sex, and Money, Sam Sanders, formerly of NPR and Vulture, looking at them saying, if these people can't make it work, then who can? I also don't want to make it seem like podcasting is going away. Like, it's obviously not. Listenership continues to grow. Projected advertising metrics show that the overall podcast advertising economy could double in the next couple of years. I just think that these companies are going to have to be much more judicious about who they invest in. And I hope they do invest, because there are audiences for these shows. These shows are not being canceled because they failed purely to reach an audience or because they're not good enough or something. It's just we have to figure out how to balance the books. And that's for a pointy-headed person at one of these companies to figure out. I couldn't tell you.
Well, you know, I had a pointy-headed person, no aspersions being cast here, but a senior leader in this company, say exactly that to me. This show is extraordinary journalism, but I can't sell ads against it, you know?
Marketplace.
No, not this show. A different show. A different show. Hopefully they can sell ads against this program.
I know, but you guys have struggled with ads too, though. Hasn't everybody?
Yeah, everybody has. Everybody has. A word here, since you mentioned Marketplace, and look, we have a podcast. You listen to us on the radio. Please do tune into your local station. But if you miss it on the air, we do have a podcast. But look, a word here about actual radio. It is instructive, I think, that three or maybe even more of the big name podcasts that are out there, The Daily, Today Explained by Vox, some others, they have gone from being podcast products to shows on the air, broadcast.
Yeah, because public radio, even though it is in many ways a aging medium, has some fail-safes built into it. We're not quite as vulnerable to the big downturns in advertising because a show like Marketplace, a show like On the Media, we're nationally syndicated, which means hundreds of radio stations across the country every month, no matter what, as long as they're keeping the lights on, they're paying us for our show. So we can lock that down. The radio business is way, way bigger than the podcasting business. The radio business, on the other hand, seems to be going down. It's declining in listenership. We have an older audience. We have a less diverse audience than the overall podcast listenership. But we're super predictable. And so even if we're dying like a slow, slow death, there's still a lot of juice to squeeze out of this.
How much does it matter, do you think, that the podcast ecosystem is so atomized, that the barriers to entry in the beginning are really, really low? And yes, distribution becomes a problem if you want to get circulation and all that. But you can do a podcast if you want to do a podcast.
It's a good question. I think on one hand, having a mega, mega hit like, Joe Rogan or Pod Save America or whatever, we're going to have fewer, I don't know, like giant culture-changing podcasts that are something like TV in the 60s, where there was only three channels, and so these personalities had outsized influence. I think you know, lots of people are experimenting with developing an audience that is maybe not going to be ginormous, but is going to pay them, you know, $5+ more a month on Patreon. There are lots of really niche podcasts that are going to be around for a long time and might even make their hosts a lot of money just figuring out how to extract money from the people who really care.
This episode of, or the episode that we're talking about of On the Media is about the end of the first boom in podcasting, which kind of implies that you, I guess, expect there will be a second boom, even though we're kind of in a bust right now?
Well, part of the reason that we got to this bust, I think, is that the picture for overall growth in podcasting was far too rosy. People expected to make their money back too fast or whatever. So I'm wary of saying that, you know, oh, this boom just ended and the next one's about to start. That would be foolish, guy. But I think the fact is that people love to listen to podcasts. We know that this is a part of people's daily media diets. And I think that once the kind of macroeconomics of this moment settle, maybe when advertisers are you know, eager to come back to our shows, when interest rates are maybe lower, then perhaps we'll see more spending, more creation of these shows. And I don't think this is going anywhere, but I think we have to be more careful this next time around. I think that's the big lesson.
Michael Owinger is the host of On the Media out of WNYC Studios. Once again, I commend the podcast episode that we were talking about to your attention, the whole thing. Micah, thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
This final note on the way out today, you've perhaps seen or heard that Norman Lear has died. The groundbreaking television producer was 101 years old. The list of his accomplishments is too long to recite here, but in 2017, when he came into our studios with his producing partner Gloria Calderon-Kallett to talk about their reboot of One Day at a Time, things turned to politics and they turned to family. Let's think about what's going on in this country right now. Yeah. And you're Norman Lear, and you're the guy who put Maude on the air and All in the Family on the air and things that spoke sharply and incisively about what was going on in this country. Right.
And we're going to be talking about, do we really want a five-year-old with a biscuit in his pocket?
And a phone. We'll turn the phone off.
I've got a very...
He always answers the phone. Right. He's answered.
Is he really going to answer the phone?
Hello?
Yeah.
There
yeah.
we go.
He always does. This is a really true
Hello?
Thing.
Wow.
Even in pitch meetings.
Oh, you're going to love this.
We would like to inform you that your membership rewards points have been...
Oh, no, you're kidding. My membership rewards...
Oh, no. Oh, this we're really, in code
this,
right
no,
now.
No, this is so don't. Important.
This is a real thing. That actually happened.
Yeah.
Here's the thing. I have six children.
Yeah.
I've told them forever, I will never, I'll always be available to you. They call rarely, but when they call, it's for something important. So I keep the phone on. I'm sorry.
Amen to that. No, that's fair. That's totally fair. And it's a lesson I could take as a dad. All right, we're gone. Our media production team, Brian Allison, Jake Cherry, Jessen Dueler, Drew Jostad, Gary O'Keefe, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Torrado, and Becca Weinman. Answer your phone when your kids call. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
Hey, everyone. It's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.